Hi, everyone. I'm at it called Star. I'm multitasking. I'm not good at it. Hold on just a second. So we're at this convention, and Kathy, I mean, there are many people here who have known Kathy probably longer than I've been clean, who she's very close with, and I just knew that she was going to have one of them introduce her. But we started walking in here, and she said, "No, it's you, babe." And I'm like, "Are you sure?" And she said, "Yeah, but you can't be mean." I said, "Fuck, you better ask Jimmy Jam to do it then." So I met Kathy, I think it was 2023. I was recording TACNA, and folks were going to lunch, and she was with Reuben P. going to lunch, and she stopped by, and she's like, "Star, that's a cool name. Is that your real name?" And I said, "Define real." And she said, "Well, is that your given name?" And I said, "Given by whom?" And she's like, "I wish I'd never asked." And I said, and I'm thinking, this bitch, you know? And then later that night, you know, it's the main speaker, and she gets up on stage, and I said, "Fuck." But I decided I was telling myself, message, not the messenger. Message, not the messenger. And she got up there, and she started talking about hiding in the closet and waiting for someone to come find her when nobody ever did. And I was like, what? And leaving pieces of herself here and there, and that recovery was about making peace with those pieces. And I was like, what? Oh, my God. And then, wouldn't you know, the very next convention I recorded, she was the speaker again, like the next month. And I was like, this woman is following me around. And that time she started talking about working through the steps and how she had worked through the steps so many times and so many, you know, decades in recovery and was still focused on the problem. And, you know, that she had now since been able to focus on the solution. I'm like, how do you focus on the solution? Like, how do you write about your character defects without thinking about your character defects or whatever, you know? And so I was like, I got to call her. So I think I asked Ruben or Dougie or somebody for her number, and I was like, "Hey, would you be willing to talk to me about what the fuck you meant?" And you know, since shortly thereafter, she's been my sponsor. So here you go. I don't know how long I can stand. Hi, everyone. I'm an addict named Kathy. Baby. Just like, for those of you that are, you know, reaching your senior years and aging in recovery, right, there's a whole nother experience with humility that takes place during those years. So just to warn you younger people that, you know what I mean, this is so I've worked really hard at trying to be very mindful of my physical self and doing what I can to try to amend the harm that I've caused myself and try to treat myself by being self-supporting and being, you know, caring for myself, you know, just watching what I put into myself and trying to be exercise and everything else. And so with all that being said, I was sure my liver was going to go because that really got tore up for years. Or I was sure that something was going to happen with the kidneys or some internal thing was going to take place that was going to take me out. Watching a lot of my seniors fall prey to that kind of stuff. And never did I think it would be my bones. And so I'm really struggling here with walking. I'm having both of my knees are on bone. I need two total knee replacements. And so it's probably going to take an act of God to keep me up here. I think God's kind of funny like that, to find ways to shut me up sometimes, to find ways to make me be still, and to find ways to ask for help. There's a whole nother level of that takes place for me, and I'm grateful. I'm grateful that I was taught early in recovery to do those things, because those things were very foreign to me as a result of active addiction. That was not a way of life in active addiction. I originally came here. I want to thank the committee, and I want to thank you guys for being so loving and so thoughtful and just so kind and generous. And well done. Good job. You guys have done an excellent job. But I originally came to Narcotics Anonymous in 1986. I had just been released from the penitentiary for, and I always say not knowing how to sell drugs. It was, and the funny part was there was just a group of us that were running scripts and doing things and making moves and, you know, eventually, you know, bundles and all the stuff that goes with that to try to just to get the next one. And they literally made a federal case out of it. Like, you hear people say, oh, they made it. You don't make a federal case out of it. They made a federal case out of it. And so, you know, I used to pride myself in, like, you know, when people would be like, you did time, and I'd be, did you do federal time? Like it was some, like, claim to fame, or it was part of my legacy or something. You know, I mean, I did bad good. Like, I did bad really good, you know. And so I came here because I was in a halfway house and you had to get the paper signed and anything. I went to any 12-step program. If I really wanted to address the symptoms that come with the disease of addiction, I could probably qualify for a dozen fellowships. And I would find myself exhausted running around to different fellowships. It's like whack-a-mole. You know, let me address this one and this. Well, here this one pops up then, and that one pops up, because it's never-ending. The symptoms are never-ending. And so I'm very fortunate that I was introduced to Narcotics Anonymous, and I came, and I was... So I had gotten some clean time in the penitentiary. I was in there for 4 years. I managed to put a year together, and mainly because I was in the hole, and because I can make some really good hooch. I came to Narcotics Anonymous as sort of a conscientious objector. I kind of thought that I had been rehabilitated through, you know, the judicial system. And the problem was the drugs. The problem was the drugs. And if you just remove the drugs, I'm pretty good at, like, I'm a really good prisoner. I do really well. I do really good in treatment. I do, when I'm confined, I do well. But when you let me out in life, I don't seem to have the rules. I don't know how, I'm not instructed well on how to do life. And so when I came with my slip, but I came to Narcotics Anonymous, and I knew you were my people. I knew you had used like I used. I knew that you felt the degradation of being ostracized by society. I knew you had been to those dark places, and I knew you felt the guilt and the shame that went with those things. But I thought that it was really sad that you lost your hustle. And I thought it was really sad that you had to go to church basements a lot. And I thought it was, yeah, really sad that you were allowing yourselves to be brainwashed in some degree. And so as a result, I would come to Narcotics Anonymous and I would look for everything I didn't like about it. You said alcohol was a drug. I said alcohol was a refreshment. You said if you ain't praying, you ain't staying. I said I'm not getting involved in some damn cult. I'm not going to be on street corners chanting steps, handing out IPs. I'm not going down like that. I'm not going down like that. The other one was don't get into a relationship for a year. I was locked up in a women's penitentiary. Yeah. There has to be an exemption to something there with that. Like, you know, please kind of thing. And then it was, I thought the women made that up because they didn't want me messing with their men. Because I didn't see it anywhere in the literature. I did look at the literature, but only to use it against you. It was a weapon, so to get you off me, to get you to back up. So it was never really used for my own self-improvement at all. So I didn't stay. And the first thing that happened was I had a drink. And the drink led to me taking pills. And the pills led to me right back where I had ended, and then it got worse. And that's pretty much how I wound up crawling back into the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous in 1988, infested with infection. I had gauze wrapped all over me, and so many chunks of me just removed, physical chunks of me. Yeah. I was so desperate and broken. I could barely lift my head up. I couldn't even reach up to comb my hair. I was so sick, physically and just withdrawing. I was so sick. I had become an undesirable for a methadone program, which I don't know how, how do you become that? That was just, I couldn't even park in the parking lot. They would come out, security would come out in the parking lot and say, you got to move, Kathy. You can't, because I'm trying to sling drugs. We're better. That's the best spot to do it, right? And so they're like, you have to go. You can't be here. You're a bad influence. I'm like, these are my people. What are you talking about? I got arrested. They came into the house. I always go to jail. I'm very fortunate. Because considering that there's jails, institutions, dereliction, and death are the ends in who's an addict. And probably dereliction scares me the worst out of all of those. Just an endless, hollow, shallow, empty survival that's never ending. But I got arrested and they went to take me to the jail. And when they got me to the jail, the guards said, we can't take her. Look, seriously, I've been thrown out of a lot of places and a lot of galleries even. They used to call them trap houses, whatever, that they wouldn't let me in them. Because I was obnoxious and because the police usually were right behind me. And so when they took me to the jail and the guard said, we can't take her, I had a moment of clarity there where, you know when it says where you just come face to face with your disease, you just can't deny the truth anymore. And I thought to myself, you have to take me. You're the jail. The jail takes everybody. You know, she said, she's in too bad a shape, you got to take her to the hospital. And it was in that moment I felt that. I felt that in the moment. When I got to the hospital, the TV was on, and the news, the 11 o'clock news was on. This had been going on all day long. It was terrible. And they said there was a big bust in Lawrenceville. It's my neighborhood at the time. Lawrenceville got this big bust, and I'm like, oh, somebody got busted. Now, I want to see who. So I'm watching the TV, and they're showing a clip of the person getting arrested, right? The shot, I said, that looks like my house. And then the next thing you know, somebody's coming out the door, and I was like, oh, snap, that's me, right? They're bringing me out of now I know my mother's watching this shit, you know, she's like totally, she hides in her apartment because she's so ashamed, the neighbors and everything else, but I saw me come out. And for the first time, I saw me straight up, with no sort of buffer whatsoever. Because I used to look in the mirror, and somehow the disease would be alert to, oh, she's going to the mirror, and to be able to say, oh, you lost weight, you look good. It has ways of. Oh, your eyebrows are really nice. It has ways of doing that stuff where we don't look at the problem. We don't see the reality of the damage kind of done. And I saw me for the first time, and it was the first time, and I had to sort of like a, I had a love-hate relationship with God, so to speak, and I kind of considered my relationship with God was like, you know, like if I would go somewhere, if people would come and they would try to cop, and then that they and I would burn them. I kind of thought that that relationship with God was kind of the same way. And then when it's my turn to cop and I have to go back to you after I burnt you, like you just know it's your turn, like you're going to get burnt kind of thing, but you're so desperate you do it anyways kind of stuff. And I kind of thought God was just waiting for me to come back and not to really burn me. And so I tried not to mess with God too much, and but that moment I was so desperate and so broken and so just lost and so alone that I cried out. And that, you know, we talk about being spiritually bankrupt, where there's just like this whisper left of our spirit, just like a whisper, because I spent so much time listening to the disease that my own conscience sort of just like lost its voice. And all that was left with the was this whisper, and I heard inside me, God, please help me. Because in that moment, I could see the future. In that moment, I could see I was going to wind up either left in an abandoned building somewhere from like an overdose or something, or I was going to end up cut in pieces somewhere that nobody was ever going to find me, or it was going to be a very tragic ending. And there was a part of me that still believed enough in me to think I didn't deserve to live like that. And I didn't want to live like that anymore. A point where we finally have that, it says, you know, complete defeat, that total surrender. It's complete where we just say, I can't do this anymore. I just can't live like this anymore. I have to be able to do something different here or take me. I'm done. I just can't. And the next thing I heard in my head was go back to those meetings. Go back to those meetings. Right now, at the time, I'm on violation of federal parole. I got 5 charges pending. I got a probation that I blew off that, you know, they finally fined me. I was really not, the things weren't looking well for me. It wasn't like, oh, I have so much to look forward to in life. Let's get clean. I never had a job. I didn't graduate from high school. I did get a GED on a bar bet, but not because I thought I needed the damn GED, because I wanted the bet to get a drink. So it wasn't even that anything, like I had nothing really to live for. I had a daughter that I had given to my mother and asked my mother, I didn't even ask her, I said, Mom, you have to take her. Because I can't keep her safe anymore. I can't even keep me safe. There's people coming in the house with guns, and there's just it's getting too crazy in here. And I can't keep her safe. You got to take her. Because I really had reached a point where I thought the lie was true. There was no way out for us. That it was, you know what I mean? We did this till we died. And we went down in like, you know, despair and tragedy. And everybody that knew us said it's a shame what happened to that poor girl kind of thing. That was all we had left. Because I didn't think there was any way to get the grip of the disease of addiction off me. And I came back into Narcotics Anonymous. I crawled into these rooms. I used to sit in the back. And I don't knock the back. I'm not knocking you back. Because I sat in the, that's right, you're here. I sat in the back and I listened to the readings. And the reading saved my life, right? And so it didn't matter where I was sitting, it was mattered if I was paying attention. And so, And so I listened to the readings, and I remember hearing, why are we here? And I remember hearing that we had to have something different, and we couldn't live and enjoy life like other people do, and that we were slowly committing suicide. And I'm like, how do these people know what's going on inside me? How do they even just say it like it's like that? This is just reality. Like it's not that serious, right? Like, because you had the answer to my dilemma. I didn't know that. Then I heard it. Star and I were talking about this yesterday, but then I heard it. Because my mother used to always say, what's wrong with you? I didn't raise you like this. And I would be like, I don't know what's wrong with me. I went to a lot of therapy. I was mandated to a lot of therapy. I did a lot of analysis, you know, psychology stuff that people were trying to fit. Nobody could figure me out. And every time I would go, and they would say, well, this one will help you. And then I'd go, and they would be like, so why are you the way you are? I'm like, what the fuck? That's why I came here. I thought you knew. And this was finally the place where someone knew. Let me tell you why you are the way you are. Let me tell you who you are. Yeah. Like every question that I had, who's an addict? Why are we here? What can I do? Like they were every question I had, you were answering every one of them. We have a disease. I was like, thank you. Because I knew something was wrong with me. Thank you. We have a disease for which there is no known cure. You got to be fucking kidding me now, right? Like, you're going to give me a disease and now tell me there's like, you can't do nothing with it, though. You're going to have this and there's no way you're getting rid of it, right? And then you said it. It can, however, be arrested. I knew arrested. My ears like opened up, my head perked up. Arrested? Arrested. Wait a minute, are you telling me that I don't have to get arrested and this disease can get arrested? Wait a minute. Is that for real that this thing can really... Look, I walked around for a good year going, you're arrested. Like, constantly. Like, you're arrested. Every time it would start scaring me, every time I would get a thought, every time I had an urge to use, every time I was afraid to be alone, like, you're arrested. I sentenced it just for today. I put it in a cell with three locks: honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. Because you said that, right? With these three, we're well on our way. It didn't mean it still didn't talk to me through the bars. It still didn't try to get the locks unlocked. You don't have to tell them everything. Do you know these are a bunch of addicts? They don't know what the fuck they're doing, right? You don't have to do everything they suggest. But it worked. I lived off slogans the first year clean. I had no idea that slogans were attached to spiritual principles. None whatsoever. But I started to realize that, I remember being somewhere in a store. I even have trouble, like, in traffic and stuff with people would cut me off and stuff like that, right? But somebody was in a store with a cart, and they cut me off. With the cart, right? Like, don't you see me coming? Aren't you paying attention to me? Don't you know what I'm getting ready to do? Like, get out of my way. Like, don't try to, like, play me. Because everything was ego-related. Everything was a test. Everything was about who was going to win. I lived in the streets. I lived in that mentality. And that mentality lasted a very long time in recovery, too. And so, but I would hear, you can't save your face and your ass at the same time. Like, I didn't know that was trying to help me with humility. I didn't know it was combating pride and ego. I didn't know that, like, this stuff was happening without me even knowing that it was happening. Chase your recovery like you chase the drugs. Like, I didn't know that you were teaching me about diligence or you were teaching me about perseverance or, you know, like, but they were working. They were working, and I was getting days, and I had all these court cases coming up, and that would start to scare me, and I'd be arrested, and I'm constantly just trying to get myself to be able to stay on the path, just so long as I follow that way, I have nothing to fear, just keep putting one foot in front of the other. I remember going to court. I got arrested at 9 months clean, on a sweep. For, you know, a sting. And so they arrested me at 9 months clean. They come in the house. I'm upstairs taking a shower. They come in the house and they, you know, it wasn't a big deal. Police, okay. I'll be bitching, said, you busted my door open and it was fucking unlocked. Why didn't you just turn the knob, right? But they come in and they're saying police, and I say, because I broke up with my boyfriend, and I said, he's not here. He doesn't live here anymore. And they said, we're not here for him, we're here for you. Well, no, wait a minute. I got 9 months clean. You can't be here for me, I'm clean. I got 9 months clean. I got a yellow tag. I remember picking that yellow tag up, and the guy said to me, you know what that means? I'm so happy I got 9 months clean, right? I picked the key tag up, and he said, you know what that yellow key tag means? And I said, what? That means I got 9 months clean. It means caution. I said, what the fuck is your problem? Why are you going to rain on my parade? Like, why are you going to... I can scare myself by myself. I don't need you to scare me. It's caution. And then I realized what he said whenever the police come in and said, we're looking for you. We're looking for you. And I'm arguing. I got 9 months clean. And they're handcuffing me and putting me in the vehicle. And I said, I'm still saying, but wait a minute. I got 9 months clean. And the guy says to me, well, you're not clean today. And so as we're driving down to go to the station, it hits me what he said. What do you mean? I'm not clean today. I said, I'm clean today. You can't take my clean date. You can't. And then I realized what no matter what meant. All of a sudden, like, here comes the slogans. I hear, no matter what, don't use. No matter how bad it looks, don't use. And I said to him, you can handcuff me. You could come in my house, handcuff me. You can take me to jail. But you cannot take my clean date. Nobody. Nobody can take my clean date, right? And so it was kind of cool because when I went to court, all these people from NA came to court with me. I was getting sentenced on a mandatory with all my, they just like put all my charges together. They were so sick of me. They just put all my charges together. And the mandatory was a 60 months incarceration. And so and when I go to court and all these people are talking on my behalf, and I mightn't have had much character, but they were character witnesses anyways. And so by the time they were done, the judge goes totally out of the mandated sentencing and gives me 10 years probation. 10 years probation. And so I used to wonder for a lot of years, do I keep coming to NA because of the probation? Like, I would wonder if I wasn't on probation or something, and I'd be able to say, girl, you was on probation, parole, and every damn thing else, and you didn't give a hoot about that, and you still was doing what you was doing. But I always wondered that. I walked off a 10-year probation that I didn't even have to report. I walked it off, and I didn't even know I was off probation. Whenever I finally like realized, oh my goodness, I'm not even on probation anymore, because it didn't matter. None of it mattered anymore. All that mattered was, don't use no matter what, and this program will change my life. And so I started getting, I got a sponsor. I used to follow her everywhere like a puppy. I was like a puppy. Didn't matter where she went. She went to Area. I didn't care. I'm stamping literature for H&I. Some other guy says, hey, come over here. They didn't ask you to do service work. They never asked me to do service work. All they'd say is, hey, come here. Come here. Get in the car. Get in the car. I didn't care because I was so scared to be alone. I'd go anywhere with you guys. Yeah. I'd go anywhere because I just believed that you kept me safe. I had a safety net. And I knew that I would be okay as long as I was with you. I wound up doing outreach. Back then it was PI. I'm doing H&I. They're taking me here. I'm doing all this service work. I don't even know what, I don't know what subcommittees even are. I don't care. I don't care. If I can do it, take me. Keep me safe. Help me feel like I'm a part of something greater than me. And I started doing some step work. I remember when I hit my second step, and I remember hearing about, like, you don't go over this step with a minimum of concern or something like that. Like, I couldn't understand, why are you getting so serious about shit? It's like, you know. But I was in a meeting, and I still was having trouble. I'd look at the floor. I didn't know how to even interact with another human being. And so I didn't want to make eye contact with anyone, because if you make eye contact, then what do I do after that? Like, do I smile? And if I smile, do you think I want you? And if you smile back, I know you want me. Like, I just, I'm sure of that, right? And does that mean we're in a relationship now? Like, how we say we lose our social graces, we reduce to an animal level kind of thing. Like, I had resorted so bad because the police were on me so much that I didn't even talk anymore. Like, I would see you, and I'd be like, and you would be like, and then I would be like, and then you'd be like that, and there was a whole conversation took place, nobody said a word. Nobody said a word, right? And my mother would be like, where'd you just go? Like, what happened? Because I didn't know how to really interact with people without trying to make a deal, without trying to conduct business, without having a transaction go on in some kind of way, whatever the transaction was. So I would look at the floor, and we were closing the meeting, and the circle couldn't get made right because you can't make a circle. And so I had to move, so I had to lift my head up, and a woman made eye contact with me. I swear to God, it felt like security was on me as when I was boosting. Like, it was like, oh my God, she sees me. And so after the meeting, the circle breaks and she's heading for me, and I know she's going to do the hug thing. I avoided hugs. The stench that came off of me from those sores that I had, it's like burnt flesh. It's really nasty. So I would avoid people because I was ashamed of what I had done to myself. And it hurts. So getting a hug, it hurts kind of thing. And so I would avoid hugs at all costs. And still, all this stuff was still going on, and I was still getting it, though. I was getting it, right? And she comes over, and I know she's going to hug, and I'm like, oh, fuck, okay. And so I get myself ready. We're going to do, I just thought I could just tap her, like Doug was talking about. Just, could I just tap and roll? The tap and roll. It's not a hug. That's officially, it's not a hug. A tap and roll is not a hug. It's like, get the fuck away from me. And so she's an embracer. She likes to hold you. She wants to put her heart to your heart. And then she wants to whisper in my ear. And she says, you don't have to live like that anymore. Something happened to me. Like, my stomach flipped and I got like chills. And I felt weak almost at the knees, like, kind of thing. And I couldn't for the life of me understand what she just did to me. Yeah. I felt like I took a hit. Like, I knew I didn't take a hit, but it felt like I took a hit. Something just woke up in me, right? And so I couldn't, I was like, am I gay? What just happened? Like, what's going on? Like, what did she just do? Like, that kind of stuff. And what I realized was that she gave me hope. I didn't know what hope felt like. See, this is a thing where I had lost my connection with the principles. What happened was when I lived the lifestyle, like I always say, if the drugs don't kill me, the lifestyle will. But the lifestyle isn't the hustle. It isn't the making moves. It's living in defects. It's living in defects and not really trying to prioritize principles. Because principles are, to me, are what connects me to God. Defects connect me to the disease of addiction. Like, I didn't even realize that, you know, like, my third step was not an easy step for me because I had grown up very religious. And the religion I had grown up in was very repentive. I was repenting all the time. I was just a sinner all the time. If you think something wrong, then you did it. You don't even have to do it. You're screwed. Like, you know, and I'm an addict and I got thoughts coming left and right. And I'm like repenting all the time. Forgive me for that one too. You know, just forgive. Oh, you know, and I feel so much shame and guilt that I can't build a relationship with a loving, caring power. And so when I came to NA and you guys introduced me to that, it was a whole new ball game for me, but I had to get an understanding that worked for me. So I had to get rid of a bunch of stuff that I had that wasn't working, and I had to start fresh. So one of my things was that, I remember a guy saying one time, my sponsor said, go talk to people and ask them about the God of their understanding. So I would go around and say, can you tell me about the God of your understanding, please? Tell me something about the God of your understanding. The one guy said the God of his understanding had a flat forehead. I said, this guy's crazy, right? He said, because all day long, God sends him messages on which way to go. Go right. Go right. He said, and I go left. He said, and God says, damn, he missed the message. And from missing the message so many times, God's forehead was flat, right? And so I thought it was crazy until I realized what he was telling me. He was telling me that no matter how many times I make a mistake, no matter how many times I turn the wrong way, fall short, settle for less, no matter how many times I do that, God will not abandon me. And that was one of my big issues with my religion stuff. And so I was able to twist that around. This one guy said to me the one time, I was like, now they used to say a lot, this too shall pass, this too shall pass. And I would always be like, when? How long do I have to wait? How long is that going to be? You know, because I always needed to know. I need to know. So I could prepare myself. And so this guy says to me one time, for someone who doesn't wear a watch, God has great timing. And I said, how does he know God doesn't wear a watch? Like, I was so, does he see God? Like, he must be really tight with God. Like, I totally missed the whole thing of the timing thing, right? Because I was starting to learn, and this was another thing that happened, that I'm on a need-to-know basis with God. Like, I didn't understand that in the beginning, but what I realized was uncertainty is a spiritual principle. I did this whole principle thing for years, right? Uncertainty is a spiritual principle. I said, that's a typo. You mean certainty, right? Somebody messed that all up. No, uncertainty is a spiritual principle. Because the very thing that scares me of the unknown, uncertainty says embrace that. Embrace it and believe, have faith, trust that you will know when you need to know, not a minute before, not a second later, but you'll know when you need to know. And with that comes some sort of relief of like, I can wait it out because I believe I'm going to be informed when I need to know. Yep. and I don't have to do all these variables of how these outcomes could possibly take place and have a plan for 60 different variables that I'm exhausted creating that never even happen. Because I've blown living in the moment and I didn't get the message because I was too busy planning what I was going to do for that outcome and that outcome. So it became really cool to start to understand that this was a loving, caring relationship. And then it's a lot easier to do four, because then I don't have to worry about being so scared, because the courage comes from my faith. Like I've always said, if I have trouble with a step, it isn't the step I'm on. It was the step before. Because I didn't get what I needed from the step before to move. Like the steps are in an order, just like walking up steps. If I'm walking up one step, the first step, that first step has to hold all my weight before I get to the second. And so in my ability to do that, where I started to realize, you got to be firm with these principles. Like I had a really hard time with surrender. Because I was always worried about who am I surrendering to, and then somebody else is going to be in charge, and I don't like the idea of that. And even if things go bad, I'd rather me be the one that makes them go bad than me have to let it go bad from somebody else running shit. And so when I found out, I found a definition for surrender that said deliberately letting go of my attachment to a specific outcome. What I realized was the reason why letting go is so hard, why do I let go with claw marks? Why do I end up in fetal positions? Why am I always scared of what's going to happen? It's because I'm attached to impending doom. I'm always thinking, help says no, don't do that. How about if you just let that go? Here's the thing that happened to me. I started to realize that it isn't that I was letting go of plans to get the outcome. And I thought I was letting go. But I wasn't letting go of the outcome. I was letting go of the plan to get the outcome. And then as soon as I'd let that plan go, I'd come up with another plan. And then I'd be like, I don't understand. I'm not feeling the relief of surrender. But it's because I wasn't surrendering to the right thing, to the outcome. Because I wasn't really putting it in God's hands. I was insisting I still had to orchestrate that kind of stuff. So after years and years, so what happens is I've never worked a job, never did anything productive in my life. I started to find my dreams in four. I started to find pieces of me that I had left behind. I started to learn how to make peace with them, get the little girl out of the closet, go get the teenager pounding up and down the steps. She's so angry. She wants to fight all the time. Go get her. Get the woman in the bathroom that wants to die. Let's go get her. Now I'm going to tell them, look, okay, your parent maybe wasn't there for you. Okay, so you weren't told you were loved. Nobody hugged you. Okay, well, I'm here now. I'm your parent now. I'm going to hug you. I love you. I'm going to take care of you. We got this. And instead of like living in my, I have issues. Instead of living in my issues, instead of living in my problems, I'm actually doing what I need to do to help myself heal. Because I'm taking responsibility through our inability to take personal responsibility, we're actually creating our own problems. I'm the problem. And I'm the solution. What am I going to be? Who am I listening to in my head? If I want to talk about prayer and meditation, and prayer is talking and meditation is listening, then who am I praying and meditating with? Am I praying and meditating with a disease? Or am I praying and meditating with a loving, caring power? Am I practicing defects and letting ego run stuff? Or am I connecting with a loving power and the principles of the program? Like my results will indicate which I'm connected to. Because I'll get trapped in the triangle. The anger, resentment, and fear will just keep happening. I'll be like a pinball bouncing off of the points. Anger, resentment, fear. Back to resentment. Back to anger. No fear. More fear. No resentment. No, back and forth. Back. 63 years old, I find out that my father, I do that little, that genealogy thing, and they give you a leaf or some shit. And I find out that I'm not, my father's not my father, biologically. That was my rock. That was my everything. Peace, babe. That was my everything. And then I find out that my father isn't my father. I got major resentments with my mother that I've made peace with. I've come to an understanding that she didn't get the things that she needed and that she couldn't give me what she didn't get. I come to have compassion and understanding and empathy and genuine concern for another human being. And I'm not so looking at what I didn't get and why I didn't get it and how it's everybody's fault that I'm fucked up. And I start to realize that we all have our stuff. And that we all go through stuff, and some of us get stuck. And that's okay. Then I'm okay, right? But I find out that my father isn't my father, and every resentment that I put to rest starts rising up on my mother. It's like giving CPR to dead situations. And I had to work really hard to put them back to rest and be able to say, it's okay, it doesn't matter. Does it really matter? Biologically? No, my dad was my dad. Whoever, only time it messes with me is when I go to the hospital and they ask for my medical history and they start asking, well, what about your father? And I'll be like, and what about him? Yeah. I don't know. And I said to the one lady, I don't know. I thought that my father was this one and he's not, he's that one. I didn't find that out until I was 63 and she turned and she looked at me and she said, I'm so sorry that that happened to you. And I was like, wow, I'm so sorry that that happened to you. And I'm able to have compassion for myself. And I'm able to comfort myself through those times. I didn't think I'd ever get to be anybody or anything. And my daughter told me, my oldest daughter said, why don't you be a nurse? You said you wanted to be a nurse when you were a little girl. And so I go to school to be a nurse. I asked them, if I go to school, will you give me a license? They say, we'll let you know. Right? It's discretion. They called it discretion. We'll let you know. And so I go to school and I apply for a nursing license and they won't let me have my graduate nursing license. She said, you got a lot of felony convictions. I said, I told you I have felony convictions. I said to my daughter, they're not going to give me a license and give me the keys to the narcotics. She said, you could do a bunch of things, Mom. Don't worry about it. You can do like the core stuff where you do the organs and blah, blah, blah. Nursing can do anything. And I said, yeah, but don't those organs have a black market, too, that goes with that kind of stuff? She's like, my God, do you think like that all the time? I'm like, yes. Yes, I think like that all the time, yes. Yes. But I went to school, and I got my license, and I went to get a job, and I couldn't get a job because I had felony convictions. And finally, I said, God, please don't say psych about the whole thing. I forgot to ask you for a job. I forgot to say, if this is your will, could I have a job as a nurse? And so all of a sudden, I get a call, and they hire me, and they say, we're going to hire you, and I could get hired as a psych nurse. God says psych, right? So after over a decade of being a nurse, I finally retired. And now I'm living the dream. I moved to Florida. I'm in a little 55-plus community. It's like Pleasantville. Everybody waves as they pass each other. I'm not sure if they're just happy they're alive still, but it doesn't matter. They're just sweet as they can be. I can go to the ocean. I can see the waves. I can feel the presence of a loving, caring power in my life. And if it doesn't get any better than that, what you gave me in Narcotics Anonymous was a way to find self-acceptance in myself. And I love you all and thank you all.